thank you for having us, and we're really happy to be here on kind of the heels of a really positive feeling success in our community, and just wanted to come because we felt like it was important to share things that we did and things that we learned, because there's places all over New York that are facing similar battles. So we were going to start with just kind of who we are, how we started, and whoever wants to jump in and start talking can.
All right. So I'm Dirk, and this all started with facing off against Flock last year that we began organizing. Some of us had, we'd heard about Flock through like hearing about it on podcasts, or I think Josh had remembered like seeing when it went through in the city. One of the things about mass surveillance systems that we'll talk about later is that they don't necessarily get implemented through policy decisions. They get implemented through procurement. So it's like, it's just like the cops buy a new police car, they buy a mass surveillance system. And so there isn't as much opportunity for public input on that. So a lot of this has been reactive. Like, it's already been input in, and now we're trying to fight it to get rid of it. We started last year when we learned about the cameras. Does anybody here not know what a Flock camera is? Okay. So Flock cameras are an AI-enabled mass surveillance system that monitors the roads, and they take a digital fingerprint of every vehicle that goes by, making a searchable database of that information. So that would be the make, model, and color, the license plate, the bumper stickers, the pattern of scratches and dents in the car. So if you swap the plates, it would still identify it as the same car. Additional features like a roof rack or a trailer hitch or things like that. And then, so then they can say, hey, show me where Dirk's car was last Tuesday, and they could show everything. Or they could say, show me every red car that went down Main Street on, you know, Wednesday the 3rd. And they could do that. They're networked across vast areas. So they could be, depending on the local policies for them, they might be networked across the entire country, in which case they're searchable by like any cop that's part of a department with a Flock contract. So, you know, 80,000 plus cameras around the country that they could search. Or it might be more limited. In Ithaca, in Tompkins County, our cameras were searching statewide. And then we eventually got to fight them down to countywide, and then eventually we were able to get the contracts revoked entirely. I'll let somebody else talk.
I'm Josh. I learned about the Flock cameras in Ithaca through a local news article from our local online newspaper called the Ithaca Voice, basically saying that the city had adopted this contract with Flock. And I was like, holy, this company is like heavily involved in Cop City in Atlanta, which, if you don't know, right around that same time, right before that article was published, actually, a bunch of state police in Atlanta had killed a forest offender named Tortuguita, who was trying to stop the police and this conglomerate of mass surveillance and police technology companies from building Cop City in Atlanta. It was a highly undemocratic process. They actually used RICO laws against activists that were simply raising money and petitioning to stop the project. So I was just flabbergasted that this was happening. I hadn't heard about it. I try to stay up on what's happening with our local government, but this kind of just like completely went under the radar. As Dirk said, it was like a really undemocratic process from the beginning.
So after like seeing them show up in the community and walking around and being like, what is that? A group of people came together. And so how did that process go? How did the formation?
Aaron over here is kind of, he likes to herd everyone into his little pet projects. And so he actually, he talked to me about it. And so there's like a group of friends that came together, and we kind of started with studying the issue. So over the first couple months, we built up a bibliography. We started talking about strategy a little bit. And then we started to gather our resources and put together forward-facing infrastructure like our Instagram, our Signal, and our Substack. But we really wanted to be very well educated on the issue and armed with all the knowledge and tools we had available in order to start the fight in Ithaca. And that's kind of when we started with our first public meeting.
And I think what really any group or any people thinking about kind of doing similar work, I think one of the things that really served us really well long term was that we did deep dives into research, and we collected, you know, articles, we read as much as we could. We actually went back and watched all of the Common Council, all of the City Council, all of the county meetings that were referencing Flock, we created a list. We like saved the link so we could reference back to when they had initially adopted it. So we basically, in probably 6 months, ended up with being more informed in some ways about the Flock and the way it worked and the ways that things had, like, were being used across the country than maybe some of the elected officials were. And being armed with, like, actual facts and knowledge and information was, I think, essential to really both building a broader outreach to our community and expanding people getting involved, because the barrier to entry was lower because we had the materials to give people to look into that were reliable and valid and trustworthy. And then we went to the electeds with that same information. And I think that is, like, in that early phase was really important.
Yeah, I'll say something that really kind of gave me a shot of hope with this issue was, I remember I was going to an arts event out of town with a van full of friends who are more, you know, like, progressive liberals. They're mostly in the arts community, and they're great people, but they're not obsessively following the news like somebody like me does. And I brought up the issue in the van, and everybody was like, wait, what? And there was just this palpable, oh my God. And, like, you don't always get that out of non-political people. And so I definitely had this shot of, like, oh, this has legs. Oh, we could push this.
Yeah. I want to mention two things that we did before we went public to really get all the facts straight and kind of, like, really get our strategy in order. We met with two people that had been working on this issue. The first was from Binghamton, who had been part of a campaign in Binghamton that was ultimately unsuccessful at that time. And then we also met with a representative from Austin, who Dirk had tracked down.
Yeah, we found local electeds in other communities where they'd successfully banned Flock and then reached out to them. And we got to speak extensively with some organizers in Austin, including a city council representative. And that was really informative.
Do any of you want to speak to that concept of collective sense-making more? Because I feel like that's an important piece.
So I been quiet because they've been talking about the beginning of the group, and I came in the second wave when there was a public meeting at the Southside Community Center, which is right around the block from where I live. And I went with a couple of friends from work. I'm an academic librarian, and I had been working with them on mass surveillance and licensing for libraries, because we, as the collections in libraries shift towards electronic, then the content is being hosted on, you know, remote servers, and we try to license them in a way that will preserve some privacy for our patrons, but we don't do a good job of it. There are no libraries that are doing a good job of that. But in educating myself about that and us, a cohort of us in the library, we did a privacy certification, which was a bunch of hours of training and study and so forth. So when I went to the Southside meeting, was there, who I knew as a parent, she said, we can win this, similar to kind of how I think Dirk was describing that. And I felt like we could, too, because I knew a bit about the Flock company, and I knew that it was, had a lot of vulnerabilities in terms of its public relations and just how outrageous it is. So when I entered the group, I started to compile the citations and so forth into a bibliography hosted on a platform called Zotero, which I'd been using for years. And if you go to our link tree, it's there. I'm going to show it to you because they wouldn't let me put this. Dirk has so many zines on our table over there that there was no room for my bibliography. So if you want to look at it, come talk to me. But it's also online. But I like this term collective sense-making because as I entered the group and I was, you know, just entering what they had already put together, and then as people were posting to the bigger Signal channel, we have two Signal groups, the organizer group and the broader one that has 90 people in it or so, people would post links. So we have a four-week data retention on the Signal channel, the big one, which, by the way, is a really important point. Like, with Signal, that's a good thing about it, because you can actually control data retention, which is hardly ever happens on any platform that you use. But the knowledge was rolling off, would roll off. So that as a tip, like think about that. If you're gathering information for your own community, how are you going to keep track of it? And how are you going to keep it, you know, build a repository of it?
In the meantime, we've already created this awesome resource for everybody to use. So.
Just start there. Yeah. Just start there.
Yeah. And I want to say a couple of things also about, like Adam was just referencing, like just how bad Flock's PR is. I mean, I think oftentimes it's hard to get people behind mass surveillance, kind of shuts people down sometimes. It's very easy to fall into security nihilism and think like, oh, well, they're watching us already in so many other ways. Like, what can you do? But like Flock like went out of their way to make themselves a ripe target. Like their machines look evil. Like they made them look evil. Like that makes it so much easier. There's like, what's that little Darth Vader thing? And so it's very easy to point at it and say, this is what that is. And for people to go, oh my God. But also, you know, the data keeps getting into the hands of ICE around the country. There is a terrible story in Texas where a woman who is a victim of domestic violence who had had an abortion, her abusive partner got the police to like use Flock to search the entire country for her. I mean, just monstrous things. And this is a company that has like a couple scandals a week. So Adam talks about like everybody's posting like, oh my God, did you hear the new Flock scandal? And they're just trickling in. You just see them like sometimes like three or four a week that we're getting posted in the channel of like new f***ed up stories about Flock. So
yeah, every couple of days, Dirk would be like, hey, new Flock scandal just dropped.
And I think that was another takeaway of, I mean, I'm jumping ahead, but I think we, you know, as part of the, we started as this kind of small group and then we went to education, right? We kind of reached out. We started expanding who we were talking to. We realized there were other people in our community. There was someone on a listserv in my neighborhood who had like sent an email saying she was doing a petition, and we connected with her and we did like building at the speed of trust and leading with trust that like people who cared about stuff that we cared about were worth talking to, and reached out to strangers and said, hey, we also care about this. You want to come and meet and hang out and talk about it? And that expanded the circle and then expanded the circle. And then we held a public meeting and we promoted it and kind of invited anyone that was interested or didn't know about it to come and shared what we had already learned. And that's where that kind of second signal chat that people are talking about, we kind of had our small group. We stayed in touch. We had our own communication. And then we created a bigger chat that we allowed anybody to really enter. We created a lot of accessibility for that, which created, you know, conversation and challenges around security and who can be in it. We can't vet who's in it. But we felt that the openness was more important at that point. And so we had many people kind of pop in there, and it created a community where people who were like interested could come, and then they were sharing. I mean, there were days where it was just like link, 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 link. And the snowballing of information gathering from that was really, really valuable. And the word of mouth, I think, as well.
Another thing about the formational phase that I want to mention before we move on is before we expanded our group, we had still had a smallish group of like four or five of us. And I remember sitting on a porch one night talking about, oh, what are we going to name this group? And Dirk and I are both veterans of the anti-fracking movement here in New York. And we're both part of a group called Shale Shock, which Dirk can talk about.
Yeah, Shale Shock was kind of... It's hard to describe exactly what Shale Shock was, because Shale Shock wasn't exactly an organization so much as it was a convening space that generated groups. And I think, you know, especially here at the Anarchist Book Fair, I think it was like really great examples of like decentralized movement building of like oftentimes like stigmergic organization, if we want to get nerdy about it, of creating a space where groups and work can emerge from. Probably like dozens of groups came out of the Shale Shock space. And I think it like really contributed to the strength of the anti-fracking movement, because it wasn't just one group that fought fracking. It was dozens and dozens and scores of groups attacking the issue from multiple angles. And yeah.
We were really inspired by the slogan that the anti-fracking movement had. I'm not sure if you remember the signs, but it was "No Fracking Way." Yeah. So we wanted something that was equally militant when we came up with our name. So that's where we came up with Flock Off.
playful. And playful, I think of like what they're saying about like surveillance is scary. The topic is heavy. It's like, it feels defeating. And I think when we decided to like, okay, we're going to have branding, we wanted it to be playful. We picked fun colors. It's a little silly. We wanted to kind of take the teeth out of it a little bit and make it, and that I think energy really fed and nourished the people getting involved, right? Because play makes people braver, actually. Like, I think, you know, like the more, you know, people will do scarier things when it's a game or when it's skydiving versus like running away and having to jump off a cliff. There's like more courage when it's a game or it's
As we're fighting against the oligarchy, it could seem really overwhelming, but it's important to remember that these people are B-movie Bond villains, like straight out of Austin Powers. They're comical in their evilness and often ineptitude. The creator of Flock Safety said he wants to end crime. Like, come on, bro.
And I think that I want to like just jump from that to the next main theme to talk about is empowerment. We weren't directing it, right? We didn't tell everyone, oh, this is how the campaign goes. This is the effort. This is the goal. We were really open and clear about what we were doing. We maintained really good open communication, I think, with the people that were interested in being involved. And we were very clear that, like, our small group is doing this stuff. Anyone that wants to come in and help, like, come on and go do stuff you want to do, right? Creating and encouraging, like, we're not telling you how or what to do. Do what feels powerful and moving to you was also, I think, a really important part of the messaging that the larger chat group kind of, it was fun to watch people build relationships as they were talking to each other about this, that we didn't know them. And you could see people who didn't know each other. And there are people who joined the group who couldn't be here today who, like, build connections with folks that they hadn't met before and didn't know through figuring out what they wanted to do. And there were autonomous efforts that happened. And I think that decentralizing of the process was really important in what was happening. So I was to give a few minutes to talk about empowerment. And then I think we should talk maybe a little bit about how we then use that empowerment to get to the actual government stuff. And then the challenges and things we overcame to be successful there.
Yeah, I wanted to say, like so for instance, like people would just spontaneously, we had somebody join into the group who she and her children had, because they don't publish where these cameras are, and some of the online resources were pretty incomplete. And like we had somebody join the group at one point who she and her children had for like weeks just driven all over the roads of Tompkins County, logging where they were and made a complete map. Like, that's amazing. That's amazing.
So does anyone talk about how that moved into the more public and direct advocacy?
Yeah, we started going to county legislature and city council meetings for Tompkins County and Ithaca. And so we were encouraging the people in the chats to come and being really encouraging, especially people who've never spoken in public before. It's scary. If you've ever spoken in public, like, I still get shaky doing that in front of a big crowd. Like, it's scary to speak in public. So just normalizing that, making it okay to be shaky, cheering people on if they do it, because it's a really brave step to, like, put yourself out there with an issue. Many people had never done anything like that before.
Our core group was always really intentional at the public comment opportunities to kind of divide and conquer. We would each pick a specific topic to speak on. Since we only had 3 minutes, we had to really do a deep dive on one specific thing. I was always like trying to be hyperbolic and like just try to scare the shit out of people with like horror stories of evil billionaires and mass surveillance. But Dirk would always like speak a mile a minute and talk about the nitty gritty details of some of these like news stories that were coming out.
I think we provided a lot of education for how to do those things. So we you know, really important, we found, to like check agendas. We actually went to a lot of meetings where it wasn't on the agenda, even from the get-go. We kind of started last summer and we're like,
we put it on the agenda.
Kind of went and like spoke and did public comment, even when it wasn't being discussed. And that actually, what we found is like the momentum would build. Is that, you know, we up until our kind of like big push in February where things got really intense and we kind of went and did, like, it's not on the agenda. They're back from, you know, we ran into timing issues of their budget season meant they really weren't going to do anything on this anyway. So there was a lull there. But when they came back from that in the winter, we kind of did a big push. And it was like, you're not talking about this, but we want you to talk about this. And I think by going with, like, not just what we don't want, right? We didn't just go and say, we don't want this. We don't, oh, this isn't it. We went and we're like, this is the world we want to live in. And what you're doing is incompatible with that. So here's how to change it. And I think that's where that research was so valuable, because we actually had answers to questions they didn't know.
Some big questions that they didn't know the answers to was, when is the contract up? And when do we need to tell Flock to flock off?
We had copies of the contract before some of the politicians did. Like, it was just absurd. Like, we knew the thing inside and out, and, like, they frequently didn't know it at all. Or it would become very clear that you know, a local elected was talking about the cameras and they didn't know what the cameras were, and they were talking about, you know, like, regular security cameras, thinking that that's what a Flock camera was, or just really kind of absurd stuff.
And we had to educate our local sheriff. You know, the sheriff system is actually an elected official. So we actually have a lot more sway with someone like a sheriff than you necessarily would with, like, the chief of police, because the chief of police is appointed. And we found that in our town, where the chief of police is kind of operating like a loose cannon and doesn't really have much accountability. Our community police board is completely dysfunctional right now. They don't have a quorum even to meet. But our sheriff, on the other hand, knows that the voters are engaged and his missteps could cost him an election.
So I wanted to say, like, a crucial bit, because it's like, okay, we're here at the Anarchist Book Fair listening to how you lobbied the government. I want to give a little bit of an explainer on that. I want to just say, like, if you want to be, like, a nerd about it, like, I think about this type of work in the sense of, like, if folks are familiar with, like, abolitionist literature, with, like, Ruth Wilson Gilmore's concept of the non-reformist reform. The non-reformist reform is a thing that you achieve through the existing state apparatus, but that removes a tool from the state's toolbox. That's how I think of this, right? It's like, it's not that we are at core reformists so much as the state is doing evil things with this machine. We should get it away from them.
Yeah, and kind of in the process of, like, confronting our local political system, which isn't super democratic. It has, like, some democratic elements and some really undemocratic elements. We forced direct democracy on our system by engaging with the system. So, and if anything, anarchy is direct democracy.
Building, like, a whole base of support independently of the state before engaging with the state, that's a key part. We didn't go straight to electeds and say, oh, this is what we care about, please do something about it. We said, we just spontaneously, you know, seem to have rolled in with, like, 100 people. This is important. You need to take it seriously. And that is a more potent way of engaging with electeds, I think.
Yeah, as one person, like, they might not really take you seriously going to a public comment. But if you show up with 50 people and signs and a giant puppet, you force them to listen.
Yeah, and about the puppet, we had over the winter a soup and art party where we gave everybody soup and we had all different types of art projects and people made signs and we constructed this puppet, which when somebody is wearing it, it's about 9 feet tall. It's very eye-catching. And so when we would have a rally before going into the city council, it would really turn heads. We were talking about, like, we put the issue on the agenda. This puppet was in all of the local media. It was in some national media. And it's playful and goofy. Like, we made a silly caricature out of this evil machine, and it was fun. You know, we had a whole afternoon of talking about politics and socializing while we papier-mâchéed this thing, and it was a good time. And that also, like, builds cohesion in your organizing group.
Every time there was a reporter around and the puppet was out, they would always want to interview the puppet, so.
Now, Dirk, you know the person in town who knows how to do these, right?
Yeah, and so that was the fun thing, too. It was like getting local artist community people involved, because a lot of times people who maybe aren't used to being activists, but they're like, oh, I care about this thing. What's the thing that they can contribute? Oh, you can make puppets, you know, a papier-mâché, you can sew, you can, you know, like, we got to bring all those people and give them a thing to do that fits what their actual skills and capacities are.
I would say we're kind of at that. I mean, does anyone want to talk about the nitty-gritty things that we felt like were essential? I'm thinking the knowledge of the where the money came from?
Yeah, like, so I already mentioned the contract and kind of Aaron actually is our FOIL expert and also a journalist. So he was kind of always working behind the scenes, like foiling, like a FOIL war against the city, basically. So we had the contract in our hands, like Dirk said, before a lot of the elected officials did. So we kind of knew when it was up. We knew the detail that we had to non-renew 30 days before the contract was up. So we had the dates kind of set, and we knew when we needed to take action based on the contract.
Yes and no. The city council in Ithaca passed a resolution to get rid of Flock first, and then we shifted to the county, which was our strategy as well, because we thought we had more support in the city. So that when we shifted to the county, we really needed to know how they were interpreting the deadline, because there were actually two contracts that came into play. There was one for the initial order, the order form, which on it they signed, and it says it auto-renews for another 2 years. And then there was the actual terms of the agreement that was signed some months later. And so there was confusion about how they were interpreting this, and we needed that to be pinned down. And some of the staff people in the county were not forthcoming with the information. In fact, I sent an email to an administrative person, and they said sent a FOIL request. And then I sent the same request to the sheriff, and then he said, oh, the date is February 28th. Because he was interpreting it, he just answered, and he was interpreting it as the order form was the date. So when you get into the details of that part of it, you do need to pay attention to those details very carefully.
The other piece of information that we needed was about the Give Grant, which is the apparatus that the state uses to bring Flock into your communities. So the Give Grant is gun-involved violence elimination, and it's a statewide initiative that does two things. It gives money to the police for things like mass surveillance, and then it also gives money to youth development organizations. In our city, it's GIAC, the Greater Ithaca Activity Center. So that would be like youth employment money that's kind of aimed at redirecting at-risk youth towards employment rather than other less productive activities. But at the very last minute, before we were getting ready to basically drive the final nail into the coffin of Flock at the city level, one of our local elected officials that happens to also be the second in command at GIAC and is a county representative was going around kind of in a like kind of a little bit of an underhanded way, using fear tactics to basically tell all the elected officials at the city that we would lose all this youth employment money if we canceled the Flock contract. So we actually had to engage with the state and the people that are involved in dispersing the Give Grant to find out, oh, actually, that's complete BS. They can use the technology budget line for any kind of technology. It doesn't have to be Flock cameras. And either way, it wouldn't affect the youth employment money in any way whatsoever. So part of it was that we had to engage directly with our elected officials one-on-one, whether it was kind of combating this misinformation or kind of schmoozing with like our county chairperson. Actually, like, we were working on something completely separate, and she started DMing me with some complimentary, you know, stuff about some of the other work I was doing separate from this in the community. So I was able to kind of use that personal relationship to kind of do a backroom deal, basically, with this one particular elected official that had a lot of sway. So it's kind of like sometimes you can use all the parts of the system that we normally think of as dirty and use them to our advantage. So
I think there was a little bit of like approaching the elected officials as allies instead of adversaries, actually, with a like, we're gonna bring that same, I think, energy of trust, of like at least giving enough trust to say, we are gonna give you the information you need to make informed decisions about this, which I felt like at the time meant that when they didn't get to say, well, I didn't know any, like what that could have, like they didn't have the out later. And I think that was really important, is that they couldn't actually support not following through. I think even if you happen to like this kind of thing and want to watch the city meeting where they voted unanimously to cancel the contract or to not renew. You see them kind of like put the police chief at the like, can the government access this information without us knowing about that? And he couldn't answer that question clearly. And it says specifically in the contract that they can. And so there was like an interaction in that meeting that I think is really telling of like, the truth here is really hard to fight again. Like, it's like, you can't, that really, I think, switched the energy.
Yeah, if you like soap operas, that meeting was actually especially dramatic. So what's the date on that? I think people should, March 4th.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would like to say, like, I think that, like, we're in a window right now where, because the Trump administration is so evil, that many liberals who might previously not take these things seriously are willing to take them seriously for a little while, and we should push on that as hard as we possibly can while that window is open. Because the second a Democrat is in office again, they will forget that they care about these things. So while that window is open, like, push them. Like, it's like if you're being kettled in a protest, you have to rush for the point where they haven't like completed the kettle. Like, that's what's happening with surveillance, right? They're kettling us with surveillance. So like rush the weak points while they're still weak.
You can see the anti-left propaganda in real time right now online. Like, they're blaming the Supreme Court decision this week on white leftists are the ones that basically took away the voting rights of Black Americans in the South. It's all us. Even we're like Schrodinger's leftists. We have no political power, but every time something goes wrong, it's our fault.
To be clear, so the renewals have been canceled, but the devices are still in place, including microphones. I don't know when they're going to take these out. I think there's some in the government, maybe the sheriff or the police, they want to have another system in place before they take them out. We're moving towards our own initiative, towards trying to push the city and the county towards implementing the ACLU's CCOPS legislation, community controlled oversight on police surveillance, is that right? Or some version of it. And ACLU is happy to work with local communities on refining the language in it that fits the actual city and so forth and with the attorney. So we're trying to do that. That's another thing that you could do as well. But we haven't removed the cameras yet. They're still there.
Before we take questions too, I think there's worth saying about this was an issue that really expanded and was like relevant across our community, and that it wasn't just the small, like the group of people that we were connected with. It expanded even farther out to other immigrant support community networks. There was a religious community network that got on board with this. And I think that this particular topic resonates across almost all of this political spectrum. And that was really important, I think, in it being successful.
Yeah, a lot of other local organizing communities would mobilize their constituencies to come out to these meetings, too.
And so one of the other things I think that was helpful is that we reached out to contacts. We went to a couple of meetings of different groups to just talk about the issue to them. And that then got them motivated to be involved and to speak out. And so when we structured, hey, we're going to this meeting, come make public comment, here's how you do it, here's when it is, come see us. We went, we greeted people, and then it just, that snowball effect again. I think there were just people who talked to people who talked to people who then brought friends and family members and came and spoke or were there to support. And so that webbing became, I think, really, it was really inspiring, but also like really important for what was happening in our community.
I think another thing that we did really well was to like celebrate our victories well. So like after we won at the city level, we all went bowling together. After we won at the county level, we all went out to karaoke. We came up with a karaoke list of songs about surveillance. It was, make sure that you have fun as well.
Should we do questions?
Hey, thanks so much for coming out. I'm another Adam. I have so many questions, but I'm only going to ask one. But I did have a suggestion. there's at least one journalist involved with you. It would be great to have Flock in a box or Flock off in a box. Basically, the kind of thing that you laid out here verbally, but written down with resources and so on. The question I have is this. So this county is just a tad different than yours, but it's not as radically different than as a lot of people think. So talk a little bit about the framing that worked with people who are not a stereotypical Ithacan, if I may put it that way. People who are, you know, maybe the kind of people that maybe they voted for Trump and then they turned sour, or liberals, you know, that kind of thing. What kind of arguments were really compelling for them?
We actually had a friend of mine who's, I guess I would describe him as a Joe Rogan bro, sit in on an early meeting. And, you know, he expressed his concern about this as well. We talked to him a little bit about what Flock was and why it was bad. And he was like, yeah, like, that's a no-brainer. So we realized, and it was kind of intuitive, but we realized that it doesn't matter where you are on the political spectrum, people like freedom, you know, and the Fourth Amendment.
I don't know if this worked, but in at the county level, I focused on a story involving a dad who was in Florida, who had been in Major League Baseball as a pitcher. And he was coaching his son's game one afternoon, and his car, when he came into the parking lot, had triggered a hit in the Flock system. And he was arrested there on the playing field as he was coaching his son's team. They dragged him off, the sheriffs did, because the Flock system, that's the way it works. It's a profile. It's actually a profile on all of us. It's just a dragnet and a profile on individuals. And then we all have a risk factor. So what had happened with this individual is 20 years earlier, he had, when he was 18, I think, he was drinking underage and was arrested. His lawyer told him that it was taken care of. He thought it was. Everybody thought it was taken care of. But Flock is also, it's a data broker. So they're dredging up data from all these places that hadn't been put together before. So there was apparently a paperwork mistake. And so it triggered this hit in the Flock system. So he was able to take care of it, but he spent at least a night in jail. So I think there are stories, and if you go through the list of all the different stories, you can find some that will resonate with people of all different stripes, I believe.
The one thing that we did stumble on, and we kind of knew that this was a potential issue when we talked with about how the campaign here in Binghamton a few years ago went, was that it was actually people from the Black community that expressed like wanting to keep the cameras because they provided a sense of security. And we knew that, you know, nationwide, but in Ithaca as well, there was kind of a rash of gun violence in 2021, which was correlated to the pandemic and the economic downturn related to that. But it ended up being, you know, a political organizer that's Puerto Rican in our community that's very, she's called the People's Mayor, but she actually came to some of these meetings and was almost in tears talking about how she was so worried about the children and wanted to keep the cameras to keep the kids safe. So we knew that that was a potential blind spot for us going into it, and we didn't organize enough around it. And that's one of the takeaways, is that we could have done better.
What would you have done if you could have gone back in time?
Constant public outreach in areas of town where there has been more gun violence, and deeper coalition building. We should have, we won, but we should have done deeper coalition building than we did.
Yeah. Yeah, and like the takeaway for me from this whole campaign was just how important those personal relationships are. I'm dear friends with, like, I could have had that conversation with her at any moment, like throughout the process. And I have a lot of other friends in the community. I'm like well known, and I've worked across those barriers a lot of times, but it was just, I don't know, like, as white people, we still have our blinders on a lot of the time. And, you know, I take full responsibility for that on my end.
I wanted to speak to you. You were also earlier saying, like, about, like, what stories might resonate with a more conservative audience. And I think some of the very recent stories, there's a guy, a YouTuber, Ben Jordan, who makes videos, has made a lot of really popular videos about Flock cameras. His videos around, I think he lives in Dunwoody, Georgia. And they were basically, through records requests, were able to determine that Flock's staff, like Flock's executives, they're not supposed to have access to the cameras themselves, but they were able to uncover evidence that Flock's executive staff had been going into the cameras, and they also have contracts with just security cameras that might be in a community as well to give police access to those cameras. And what they were able to determine was that a community center in Dunwoody, Georgia, whose own security system was routed through the Flock system, that Flock executives had been going in there and like watching children's gymnastics classes.
And women's fitness classes, yeah. Like really gross, yeah. Slimy.
They're comically evil. I mean, it's not even comical. They're just evil.
You know, there's a stereotype about cops, right? All cops are... Well, all surveillance tech CEOs are slimy creeps. It's just a personality type that's attracted to that kind of work. And I think that's a weak spot. That's the weak underbelly, or one of the, like the, what is it in Star Wars, that 2 meter wide heat exhaust port where they shoot them, they shoot those missiles down that little hole, like find the underbelly and go directly after it.
Were there more questions?
Yeah. So we're attempting to organize a planning meeting for this on Tuesday, and you touched upon the non-surveillance alternatives, and I think it's definitely on my mind. What other suggestions would you have? I'm thinking community building, police alternatives. I really feel like for our area, if we focus on that more, considering the fact that we are a little bit more diverse in our political makeup, we might have a better chance at this. I'm just curious what other alternatives you would be suggesting as well. Thank you.
One thing you might think about is looking at that CCOPS legislation and see what it covers and share that with the group and have a conversation about if it meets their needs or if it's missing anything. One thing, you know, that is for sure, like with any of these systems, they end up, if they're networked, and they all are, then there's always going to be somebody, a tech at the company that has access, and there are always going to be ways to, you know, share it in different ways because data brokerage is such a big industry. So if you can look at whatever system you're looking at in terms of like the data lifecycle, there's collection, there's processing, there's disclosure, sharing, retention, and destruction. Like if you can't get answers to all those, then you don't really understand how the system works and you have no control over it.
And the whole idea of we keep us safe is not just a slogan, that's like really how it is, you know? So like building those coalitions with the anti-ICE movement right now, there's all these rapid response groups. I think we can really build off of that model when it comes to just like community safety and watching out for each other, not in the sense of like a community watch, which has a lot of negative connotations, but community response to violence, to domestic violence, to safety issues in the community. Like, how can we deal with those issues without the police involved, without the federal government, and without meeting violence with more violence?
I also wish one of our other members was here because she had like more of a hand and was aware of the programming. But I think of like the one barrier that kept getting thrown is that this money is coming from the state and here it is. And if they take that money, we lose this money for this youth employment program, which is actually really good. And that I think that program was doing really good things to create safety in the community, right? Because it was like giving kids opportunity and like training and job skills and like getting them stuff they could be interested in and invested in and feeling empowered and strong. And so I think like that kind of, for me, that's like, how do we, you know, that kind of stuff is really, really important. I'm a kid-minded person, but like getting kids stuff that makes them feel like a part of the community too and that they're invested in caring for it, that to me feels really important to think about.
Yeah, giving kids like musical
instruments.
Getting
more money for programs like that rather than stupid cameras that I think one of the local communities that did also decide not to renew because as the city and the county didn't renew, they had a very small, I think they only had 4 cameras. And so they were like, well, if we can't network with Ithaca and Tompkins County, we're not getting a lot of information. And also we only used it twice in a year, and so it's kind of not worth it anymore to pay for it. And so like, yeah, giving the money to like stuff that makes people's lives better rather than just videotapes them.
Yeah, so to echo that and add a little more detail, like if you can find out, get the contract and find out how much is being spent on those other systems, then you'll know how much money there is to work with for other programs. And you need to shift the people in the government, their attention to like how else they could be using this money because of that procurement process with the Give Grant. Like it's the police that have the initial control over it, and they have all the details. They know the contract dates, they know the amounts and all that. And they don't share that openly, at least they didn't with our community. So getting to the essence of what they're spending, I think, is really critical.
Thanks for this great talk. I'm curious if you guys know if how they're processing all this data, if Flock has like a giant data processing center that's impacting a community, and how they are able to take all this massive amounts of data and use it.
I don't think we've come across an article about that, and who knows where they, you know, different places they're storing it. I doubt that it's in one data center. You know, it's probably spread all over the place.
That would be a really great research project for somebody to take on.
The fusion centers.
Yeah, but I mean, it directly relates to all the activism around stopping data centers from coming into our communities. We're fighting against one right now that's proposed for Cayuga Lake that's going to be drawing water out of our lake. So not only are there the environmental issues, there's also the energy usage. They're bumping up energy prices by like 200%, something like that. And in addition, a lot of that AI computing power is going to be used for surveillance. Like they're using robot dogs to patrol these data centers. They're like getting rid of jobs. They don't have any economic value for the local communities, and they're going to be used to take our freedom away. So those two things are very closely related, I think. The fusion center would include the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, Border Patrol, ICE, all these different alphabet agencies that are actively involved in taking freedom away from our neighbors.
I want to just briefly like plug some of the organizations whose work we were able to stand on the shoulders of, because they did so much of the work in gathering the news and reporting on doing the investigation. And so if you're interested in following this issue, I recommend you check out the following groups. Definitely the Electronic Frontier Foundation, 404 Media, the Digital Defense Fund. The ACLU has great stuff on Flock. There's a anarchist group in the South called SASSI, S-A-S-S-I, that does really great research work on surveillance and municipal organizing. Just check those groups out if you're passionate about this issue.